Today is Thursday, April 19th. We're going to work on a fluid electrolyte review and exam 4 review today.
You said 121?
Yeah, about 121 is a good place to look. Okay, so what I'd like to do is just kind of repeat this stuff with you one more time, make sure we're on the same page, make sure we're feeling comfortable with this stuff. In class on Tuesday, we talked about the balance between fluids and electrolytes. So we already know from having covered this stuff way back in chapter 19 that there's two pressures that battle at a capillary. What force pushes fluids out of a capillary?
Hydrostatic.
Good. So we know that hydrostatic pressure is based on fluids. It is a force that pushes fluids out of the capillary. And it tends to drop over the length of your capillary from around 35 millimeters at the arterial end to around 15 to 17 at the venule end. Do you know why we have a drop in hydrostatic pressure? It's filtering, right? It's pushing it out. Good. Okay, so we'll put 15 to 17 down here. All right, and the battle occurs between the push of that fluid forming the hydrostatic pressure and the pull or attraction created by salts and proteins. What pressure is created by salts and proteins?
Osmotic.
Good. And does it change along the length of your capillary?
No.
It stays the same. Good. Okay, so when we talked in here on Tuesday, as we have before, there is an overall net filtration pressure that accounts for this push-pull battle occurring here. The overall net filtration pressure at your arterial end is about how much?
10.
Good. And of course, that's millimeters mercury. Okay, and so I'm just going to put a star here beside hydrostatic pressure. It is the force that allows us to push and filter. Okay, and at the venule end of our capillary, our overall pulling ability relies on which pressure?
Osmotic.
BOP, good. And when we do the math again, we come up with an overall net filtration pressure of?
Negative 8,
right. Okay, so ideally under normal circumstances, this is what we expect to see. We expect to have a force that pushes fluids into the interstitial space. That's filtration. We expect to have them reabsorbed at the venule end. Now, about 90% of those fluids do get picked up at the venule end of your capillary. The remaining 10% hanging out here in your interstitial space go where?
The interstitial fluid.
They're in the interstitial fluid.
Lymphatic.
So the lymphatic will eventually pick those fluids up. The 90% of the fluids get returned here, but what happens to the remaining fluids in the interstitial space? Okay. All right, so this is normal. This is what we expect to see under normal circumstances. And of course, where we went on Tuesday was to the imbalance category. So there's two imbalances that we talked about. There's an imbalance called dehydration, and there's an imbalance called overhydration, or sometimes it's just called hydration. We look at dehydration from the perspective of what we're losing, and so our perspective is, what are you primarily losing from the bloodstream? If you're primarily losing fluids or salts and proteins, or perhaps maybe you're losing both fluids, salts, and proteins. So again, our perspective for dehydration is one of loss. What are we losing from the bloodstream? When we talk about overhydration, our perspective here is that of what are we gaining? So if we're getting too much of something into the bloodstream, then we say it's an overhydration issue. So So this time our perspective is of one of gain. Are you so far so good?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when we talked about dehydration, the easy form is isotonic dehydration. What happens to our fluids, solutes, and proteins during isotonic dehydration? You lose both of them, right? So equal loss of salts and proteins and water. Okay, so let's make a note. And do you have any net gain or net loss of fluids from your interstitial space or cells?
No.
No net change. Good. My clue word for you, come test day, is equal or same. If I say to you we're losing the same amount of salts and proteins, or the same amount of water and proteins or electrolytes, same or equal is going to be our clue word to look for. There is no net change in fluid movement here. Okay, so that's the easy case. All right, so let's talk about hypotonic dehydration. And like I mentioned on Tuesday, we already know that hypotonic solutions will make our cells bloat. So we're just going to figure out how do we get to the point of making them bloat. Well, what are we losing from the bloodstream?
Salts.
Salts or solutes, good. Well, we know there's two battling pressures. We know that one of those pressures, BOP, is the one that represents the amount of salts and proteins in your bloodstream. If you're losing salts and proteins, you're going to lose blood osmotic pressure. Blood osmotic pressure is not the force to filter, it is the force to do what?
Reabsorb,
right. So if you can't reabsorb, that means that your fluids are hanging out in your interstitial space and can even move where?
Intracellular,
right. So ultimately, there's where your cells will blow. So loss of BOP there, this causes fluids to move. All right, so from capillary, where next? Yeah, interstitial fluid next, and then finally intracellular, good. If we have extra fluid in the interstitial space, we technically call that edema. And if the fluids then move into the cell, we now say your cells will bloat, okay? Technically, yes. So if you've got an imbalance that increases your BHP, it kind of works the same as decreasing your BOP. Yeah. Lauren?
So an increase in intracellular fluid would not be called edema?
Correct. Okay. Correct. And I think that's really weird because how do you swell in one place and not the other?
Yeah.
But apparently what happens is it fills the interstitial fluid first, and then eventually it will force its way into the cells when that space is filled. So, but yeah, technically it's interstitial space. Okay, so let me give you some examples. If somebody has, let's say hepatitis, we would say that hepatitis impairs your ability to produce blood plasma proteins. So without, say, albumin and other plasma proteins, we cannot reabsorb here at the venule end of our capillary. So with reduced reabsorption, what happens to our cells and tissues?
They swell.
Yeah, they fill up with fluid. There's more fluid being pumped out to that interstitial space. Yeah. So IF and then ICF. Good. So if they're losing blood proteins, which pressure is primarily affected?
Osmotic.
Good.
What's another example besides the liver?
There could be. If we've got somebody with Addison's disease that doesn't have enough salt retention, that would also lead to a loss of BOP and swelling.
Okay.
We can look at somebody that has, trigger my brain here, severe burns, vomiting and diarrhea. you know, when we have vomiting and diarrhea and we have burns, we can lose fluids, but the bigger issue is that we're losing proteins and solutes.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's why I try to give you clues, because it may not be obvious as to what the primary loss is. Sometimes we end up losing more fluids than we lose solutes and proteins, and that is classified as hypertonic dehydration. Okay, and that of course affects BHP, which is blood pressure or blood hydrostatic pressure. Is hydrostatic pressure the force that pushes fluids out of your capillary or pulls it back in?
Pushes
out. So that means that if you drop your BHP, that means you're actually able to do more reabsorption. And so you pull from the interstitial fluids, and then you finally start pulling fluids out of those cells. So what happens to your cells?
They shrink.
They shrink, they shrivel. Good. So I think I mentioned to you on Tuesday, I'm writing this kind of funny, whoops, just to make it easy, I said we pull from ICF into the IF, but in reality, where are you pulling from first?
The IF.
The IF, yeah. And then finally back to the capillary.
Now, Ms. Taylor, this is where absorption just continues to happen. There's no filtration.
Yeah, there may be very little or none, yeah. So you're just reabsorbing like crazy. Okay, so for some examples here, you know, diabetes is a great example of this, because either form of diabetes, whether it's mellitus or insipidus, results in fluid loss from the kidneys. So either case is going to be massive amounts of fluid loss. Because the primary issue here is losing fluid, then we say it's a BHP issue. We're losing that hydrostatic push, and instead we're pulling fluids, we're reabsorbing from that interstitial space and from our cells back into the capillary. Well, when this fluid goes to your kidneys, you know, your kidneys say, hey, look at all this extra fluid that we don't need. So what happens to it?
Keep
dumping it out. So you lose that fluid in your urine, and unfortunately your cells shrivel and you know, prenate during that time period. So sometimes, you know, I may not need to give you a clue. I think diabetes, we've talked about the three cardinal signs for mellitus, polyuria, polydipsia, and one more,
polyphagia.
So we know already for that one, the big issue is fluid loss, okay? Diabetes insipidus only has two of those symptoms. They are? Yeah, polydipsia and polyuria. Again, still the issue is fluid loss. So if I said to you, we've got an ADH problem, we're not making enough ADH, again, what is your thought process here? Loss of fluids, right?
Hypertonic,
yeah. Hypertonic, right. So there's some things that I may not need to give you a clue for, but others I will need to. So if you're looking at an aldosterone issue where you're not making enough, then how would you classify that, a hypertonic or a hypotonic issue?
Hypotonic.
Because you're not retaining enough
salt.
Yeah. And if it's an ADH issue, you're specifically looking at water, a hypertonic issue, right? So some of those, you know, just think about what you already know about them. ADH, aldosterone are good examples. We know diabetes, good example of a fluid loss issue.
ADH was hypertonic.
ADH is hypertonic, yes. So if you've got insipidus or some low level with ADH, yeah. The last type is actually an overhydration or a hydration issue. We called it water intoxication here on Tuesday. So there are other forms of overhydration, but we just selected this particular one. This case results from a gain of too much fluid that causes an imbalance of having not enough salts or proteins. So again, our perspective for overhydration is one of gain. All right, so which pressure do we increase if we're getting too many fluids?
Hydrostatic.
Hydrostatic. And, you know, we talked that it actually means that you have too few salts and proteins. So if you were looking at it from a perspective of loss, you're actually losing salts and proteins when you're getting too many fluids. If you lose, you know, or if you're gaining, rather, this ability to push fluids, you know, we have to worry about those fluids traveling into the interstitial space first, and then where do they travel next?
ICF.
Good. So capillary is where we start with these extra fluids. They move to the interstitial space, to the ICF. Good.
So you said basically what's happening here is your body can't filter it out as much as you take it in?
That's right. Okay. So if you have somebody that says, I'm really, really thirsty, I haven't drunk all day, and they just down, you know, lots and lots of liquid, the kidneys are only filtering so fast, you're right. So unfortunately, it gets pushed into the interstitial space in the cells.
And then if it shuts down something in the brain?
It can make your brain swell.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
The interesting thing is both hypotonic hydration and hypotonic dehydration behave the very same way. So, you know, it's whether you lose salts or gain fluids, you still push fluids out into that interstitial space, and you still can have the risk of cells bloating and brain swelling and things of that sort. So, you know, just want to make the comment here that if our perspective is losing salts and proteins, we're going to call it dehydration. But if our perspective is of gaining water, we now call it overhydration, right? So it's all about your perspective of whether you're losing from the bloodstream or whether you're gaining too much of something into the bloodstream. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How do you feel about this stuff today? Are you about an 8 on the scale of 1 to 10?
Yeah.
That's good. I mean, if you're there, that's a really good place to be. Okay. Yeah.
On the test, so we're going to have to know where the fluid is going to go to whichever condition.
Yeah, I may say to you, if we're in hypertonic dehydration, tell me how the fluid movement occurs. So, yeah, you'll want to know this part.
Okay.
Okay. Let's see. I think if we had done a few of those questions on 124, why don't we head back there? Okay.
In our tubular resorption, you said that each one kind of pairs with something except the amino acids.
Correct.
So they're going to be whatever. They're going to reabsorb the obvious, whether they have the pair.
Yeah, that obligatory reabsorption occurs for sodium and its buddies, glucose, chlorine, bicarb.
Mm-hmm.
All of them come back together, water.
And you said water also follows glucose.
Yeah, water can follow glucose. So if you've got it in the filtrate, it'll stay in the filtrate.
Okay.
Will
it follow both the same kind of salt and the glucose?
I think it depends on the concentration gradient, which one has a stronger attraction. Because if the sugar has a stronger concentration gradient, it may go there.
Okay, and in that reabsorption, everything is being absorbed, whether you need it or not.
Correct.
Okay.
That's right. You're going to have to remind me, we did numbers 2 and 3. Did we hit number 4?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. But not number 5.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So if you read number 5, it says lymphatic obstruction in the arm. You know, the lymph system does pick up escaped fluids. But the bigger issue here is the escaped proteins that are stuck now in the interstitial space. If you can't pick up those escaped proteins, they create their own osmotic pressure out there in that interstitial fluid. So unfortunately, that leads to a loss of proteins from the bloodstream. So that's our primary loss that we're looking at. That's one of those ones I'd probably have to give you a clue on, because you're probably thinking, well, hey, lymphatic system transports all these escaped fluids, but it's the protein loss from the bloodstream that becomes the bigger issue. Okay, so knowing that it's loss of proteins, would you call it dehydration or overhydration?
Dehydration.
And what specific type?
Iodine.
Good. And what pressure are we losing?
Osmotic.
Good. BOP. And of course, here's the fluid movement. Because you're not able to reabsorb, we push fluids from the capillary
interstitial
ICF. Good. So cells will bloat.
You want us to put with the hypothalamus, put where it is overhydration or dehydration?
Since it's mostly multiple choice, you won't actually have to tell them.
Okay.
And there's, I think, maybe one potential essay that you can answer on.
Okay.
So the lymphatic obstruction really had nothing to do with anything on that?
It didn't have anything to do with what?
Like, it really didn't have anything to do with pressure. Lymphatic obstruction.
It does have something to do with pressure, but it's the osmotic pressure. It's primarily the proteins that are lost that it's causing an issue with. Is that what you're asking? Yeah. So it's the lymphedema that can result where people's body parts swell is actually due to the proteins that are attracting the fluid and keeping it out there in that interstitial space. But the trick is it can lead to loss of blood pressure because there's no longer the ability to pull the fluids back in into your capillaries. So it continues to get worse. Number six, there we have a diabetes situation. This one is a loss of fluids. That's one that I may not need to give you a clue for, since you know diabetes makes us lose fluids greatly. What pressure are we losing?
BHP. Good. And this is hypertonic dehydration. So we've lost our ability to push. We have still retained our ability to pull and return fluids. So how do the fluids get back into the capillary? ICF to IF, back into the capillary. Okay.
Let's see. Number seven is called hyponatremia. This technically means low sodium levels in the bloodstream. This can be caused by things like lack of aldosterone. So knowing that the issue here is loss of blood sodium, we're looking at which pressure primarily affected.
Osmotic.
Good. So BOP is lost. Now, since we know it's a loss issue, we know it's a dehydration issue. Okay, and so what type of dehydration?
Hypotonic.
Good. All right, and so our ability to reabsorb is diminished. We can still filter and push fluids out, so they move from the capillary to the IF, to the ICF. Good. You doing okay with these so far?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any questions? Let's think about number eight. Number eight talks about high blood pressure. And if you think back to our heart chapter, you may recall that our whole blood pressure issue is based on cardiac output.
Mm-hmm.
Cardiac output is based on fluid volume. So this kind of brings us full circle with this conversation. If you've got high blood pressure, that means there's higher cardiac output and higher amounts of fluid. It may not mean that your sodiums and proteins are going to balance it, though. So in relation to your high amount of fluid, you may have a disparately low number of sodium and proteins in the bloodstream. That's our issue, loss of blood proteins and solutes. Okay, so which pressure do we lose for number eight?
It's osmotic,
yeah. And you're right, it is hypotonic dehydration. Good. And I give you a moment to jot down the way the fluids move. Fluids move from the capillary to the interstitial space to the cell. Thank you.
you said for the blood pressure issue, that meant it's higher cardiac output as well as higher fluid.
Higher fluid, So with these, they always work against each other.
Which one?
With the osmotic and the hydrostatic. So if the reabsorption is not working, it's going to be a pressure.
Yes.
It's going to be a reabsorption not working, the pressure is going to work.
That's right. The only issue where you would not have them counterbalance like that is when you have isotonic.
Right.
But otherwise, yeah, if you decrease reabsorption, you're automatically increasing filtration.
Okay.
Yeah. Just something for fun. For number eight, you know, I had mentioned we approach this one with the perception of loss. What if we approach number eight with the perception of gain? Too much fluid.
Overhydration,
yeah. And because we're gaining too many fluids, it would be hypotonic. Same results there, right? Your cells would still swell. So, you know, it depends on what your perspective is, whether it's a loss perspective or a gain perspective. Number nine there, loss of fluids, once again, is the issue. Too much salt compared to the amount of fluid that we're getting. So since we're looking at this as a loss of fluids, what pressure do we lose?
Hydrostatic.
Good. So lose BHP. And this is what type of dehydration?
Hypertonic.
Good. Hypertonic. And I'll give you a moment to jot down that fluid movement from the ICF and IF. The fluids move back into the capillary. So hypernatremia or hypertonic drips or drinking salt water all have the same effect. They give you an imbalance where there's not enough fluid compared to the amount of salt that you're getting. So ultimately, in any of those situations, drinking salt water, you know, having excess salt in your bloodstream from hyperaldosteronism, those will all cause dehydration of our cells. All right, number 10, glomerulonephritis means inflammation of the glomerulus. What happens during inflammation is those membrane slits that allow small stuff to pass through become inflamed, and now big stuff can pass through, like blood proteins and blood cells. That's when we start to see these blood proteins and cells show up in the urine. So under this condition, we may see loss of blood proteins. That means we're losing which pressure?
Osmotic.
BOP, good. And you would classify this as what type of dehydration?
Hypotonic.
Good. And I give you a moment to jot down how the fluids move. They move into the interstitial space and into the cell. Cells, of course, bloat. If I'm reading you right, I think you have a good sense of this page. You feel pretty comfortable with it, okay? If you want a little more practice, I did leave you answers on the bottom of 125, about eight or nine more there to play with. So if you feel good about that page, I think you will have a good handle on at least this chapter for the test. So that makes me feel good about you going into the test whenever you decide to take it, whether it's early or next week. All right, so the floor is yours. What would you like to review now?
We're not going to go over the reproductive system?
Not today. We'll do that next Thursday.
And could you go over the...
Sure, why don't we start with 106 and do that to 109. That'll hit the whole thing. Okay. I'm going to erase the board. Anybody need a picture before we go there?
I do.
That's what you might, if you want to pour.
Okay.
You're welcome.
Yeah,
I'll pour it.
Anybody else need a picture? I'm in here. Do y'all hear the music next door?
Yes.
It's like, I think it's Pirates of the Caribbean, you know? I'm dying to know what class that is, and the semester's going to end, and I'm not going to know who is over there. You go see who's teaching that. I started to sneak out.
Where was that? It's right here. It's
5403.
I'll tell you what they look like. I'll take a picture of the teacher.
While she's fine for us, we'll get this thing going. Okay, so if you want to follow me along, I'm going to use the picture that's in your course pack, page 111. You were taking art class, right? Okay, I want to make it big enough so we can do all of our writing here.
Whoa. Can we take a picture of this?
Oh, absolutely. I'll definitely leave this up for you. Okay, so the first thing I want to mention to you is you're looking at a nephron. And one of the things I want to review is going through that blood flow pathway. You know, part of the picture's missing here. I've only got arcuate artery and cortical radiate artery here, but we know we started back with renal artery, segmental,
interlobar,
then arcuate,
cortical
radiate. And just to kind of give you perspective, that arcuate artery sits at the base of one of those renal pyramids. So when you're looking in lab at those models, that arcuate artery should always be sitting horizontal because it's at the bottom side of one of those renal pyramids. The cortical radiate artery is going to be running vertical, so it's going to be sticking up in this direction on your models. We are then going to take off at this afferent arteriole. We're going to travel through the glomerulus. And if you're a blood cell, red, white, platelet, or if you're a blood protein, that continues on through the efferent arteriole. I do want to mention that that efferent arteriole changes names. As it begins to wrap around your renal tubule, we call it a set of capillaries. What capillaries wrap around these?
Peritubular.
Good. So we'll just do this and label that as peritubular.
What did you say it was from the glomerulus into the ether?
Oh, yeah, blood cells, proteins.
Okay.
So they're just going to go on a joyride through the glomerulus. They do not get filtered. So their pathway will take them on to the afferent arteriole, over here to the peritubular capillaries, and eventually to a venule. Good. And the venule joins us up with cortical radiate vein. Arcuate vein is next. Good. And from the arcuate vein, where do we head next?
Interlobar vein.
And renal vein. Good. So let me repeat. What we're doing is blood flow through. And when you take blood flow through, you're not looking to filter red blood cells, white blood cells, platelets, or what?
Proteins.
So they will travel all the way through your glomerulus, afferent arteriole, peritubular capillaries, and they'll continue on their venous pathway back out. Okay. In terms of our renal tubule, we have the PCT, this loop here, we got a VCT, and then you're quickly running out of options to reabsorb by the time you reach your collecting duct, because dripping from the tip of your collecting duct is what? And it's now called
urine.
Yeah. So if you've made it this far, then you're pretty much running out of options to reabsorb anything. So let's start down here with the glomerulus. This is filtration, page 106. And when we do filtration, where do we perform this activity?
The glomerulus.
The glomerulus. Good. What do you happen to squeeze out of your blood plasma to form the filtrate?
Electrolytes.
Waste even get filtered.
Glucose.
Sodium.
What's that?
Sodium.
Bicarbonate.
Proteins.
Tubulin. Yeah.
Hormones.
Water. Good.
Good.
So filtration occurs here in the glomerulus. The stuff we squeeze out of your blood plasma is things like water, electrolytes like sodium. We squeeze out waste products. We squeeze out good stuff like glucose, big, you know, not necessarily bigger stuff, but amino acids, which are the building blocks for those proteins. All that stuff we now have to sort through and figure out what we want to keep and what we want to discard. The stuff is no longer called blood plasma. Once it's captured by your capsule, it's now called
filtrate.
Okay, so filtration happens here. It relies on a net filtration pressure of about what?
10
millimeters mercury. Good. And that ensures a glomerular filtration rate of about how many milliliters per minute?
120.
Good. All right, so if you're not filtering enough stuff out, you have the potential to keep too many fluids, too many electrolytes, even too many waste products could be kept. So it's critical that we have a high enough net filtration pressure to keep our filtration rate going at this speed. If you have low net filtration pressure, there's a specialized set of cells sitting right up against your glomerulus called the JGA, and they will release what?
Renin.
That then travels to the
kidney or the liver.
Liver, and your liver makes some releases.
And it converts it to afferent
arteriole. Good. Afferent arteriole is constricted. That maintains filtrate formation. And you're right, now you make ADH and aldosterone. So you've got multiple effects that become about as a result of having low blood pressure. So I'll just put a little triangular shaped region in there, and we'll just make a note that's the JGA.
Now, when the blood pressure is low, it squeezes the efferent arteriole.
Right.
It stops it
from escaping, backs it up, and
to make your blood pressure higher.
That's correct. Okay, make your blood pressure higher.
Now, a question about the JGA. You said our nephrons are folded. So technically, the JGA is near the collecting duct.
DCT.
Near the DCT. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So if you took this off the board and rolled it like this, gave itself a hug, that's the reality of it.
Okay. And then the podocytes are they like little cells, or are they all around the capillaries?
They're like octopus-shaped cells like this, and they're actually porous. There's holes in them, so stuff can escape out their little arms. Yeah, but they're wrapped around, they're part of the membrane structure of the capillary.
Okay, so it is kind of wrapped around, but it has pores on it.
Has pores on it, yeah.
Okay.
They call them membrane slits. I kind of think of a mail slot. It's just
okay.
Big enough to let certain stuff through.
Okay.
All right.
So,
yeah.
So, can you repeat the function of the JGA?
JGA's job is to monitor blood pressure. If blood pressure is too low, it turns on the renin-angiotensin mechanism. So the goal then is to, of course, make sure that you can still make filtering. Any other questions so far?
Okay. With this whole progress, I know that there's two different types of nephrons. Is that that's for both nephrons, right? Or
this is for both. And the most common type is cortical, which is what I've got drawn for you here. Any other questions? So let's take our filtrate and let's move it down here to the PCT. And at this point, your body's going to take back a lot of items, whether or not it needs it. And because we're reabsorbing these items, whether or not we need them, we call this what? Reabsorption?
Obligatory.
Obligatory. Good. So we're going to call this obligatory reabsorption. And this reabsorption allows us to move items from the filtrate and the tubule system back into a set of capillaries. What capillaries?
Paratubular
capillaries. Good. So we're moving these items often by, you know, facilitated diffusion where we have protein channels, sometimes by active transport back into the bloodstream. There's a ringleader here. It is sodium. When you reabsorb sodium, what comes along as well?
Water.
Water. And
nutrients.
Chlorine, yeah, glucose. Bicarbonate. And then amino acids come too, but not coupled up with this sodium group. Okay, so sodium's kind of a ringleader for a lot of the items we reabsorb. If you take back sodium, you're going to take water, you're going to take chlorine. How much glucose can you take?
180 deciliters.
Good.
Can you say what the term you used again?
It's called a transport maximum.
No, the first thing that you said.
Reabsorption?
Yeah.
Obligatory.
The reabsorptive process
Right. Takes
these items back into the peritubular capillaries.
Okay.
And maybe by active transport or facilitated diffusion, but nonetheless, we're rejoining the blood flow.
Okay.
Did you say something about obligatory?
These are all obligatory. We take them whether or not we need them.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yep, obligatory. Now, if your blood glucose levels are 400 or 500, then you're only going to keep about 180 units, and then the rest of it leaves in the urine. We call that an osmotic diuretic, because water tends to follow this high concentration of sugar in the filtrate rather than coming back into the bloodstream. So it's kind of a steeper concentration gradient there for that glucose. Bicarbonates act as a base. They can make your blood pH become more basic or alkaline. So under what conditions might you want to reabsorb these bicarbonates, more of them?
If you're acidic.
Yeah. So I'll just make a note here that bicarbonates make your blood pH
increase.
Good. So a couple of special cases there. Glucose has a special situation. Bicarbonate is a special situation. All right, so this is reabsorption in the PCT. Obviously, we didn't take everything out of the filtrate. We took only what, you know, maybe 60 to 70% of the items there. That means there's still fluid and a lot of things that we could potentially keep traveling on down to this loop of Henle.
As we travel down the loop of Henle, there may be aquaporins there that reabsorb only what?
Water.
Only water. Good. We call this kind of reabsorption really long name. Countercurrent. Yeah, that's it. Countercurrent multiplication. This is a special setup. Normally, water and salt get reabsorbed together, but here in this loop of Henle, we're going to separate them to adjust the saltiness of your filtrate. So we only reabsorb water on the descending limb, and we only reabsorb sodium. Good.
Okay, so the countercurrent multiplication is in the loop of Henle just period, or it's on a certain side?
It's the whole loop of Henle, but that's the only place it occurs. So water falls down, water, of course, reabsorbed in the downside, the descending limb. Ascending limb only takes sodium and chlorine. And so the whole goal here is to adjust the saltiness of your filtrate. They're coming out. They're coming in from the renal tubule into your peritubular capillaries.
Okay.
So I'll put that right there. Let me make a point here. Back in the PCT, water was reabsorbed with sodium. They were a tag team coming back in. But here in the loop of Henle, we've actually separated them. So the only place in the entire nephron that water is reabsorbed by itself or has the potential to be reabsorbed by itself is in that descending limb. Okay. By the time we reach our DCT, we may have some hormones present. What hormone would help us reabsorb more sodium if we need it?
Aldosterone.
Good. ADH may also be present here. That will help us reabsorb more water. What conditions, what problem do we have that necessitated those two being here? Dehydration?
No.
Low blood? Pressure. Yeah. So if you have aldosterone and ADH here at the DCT, that says, hey, we were dehydrated, we had low blood pressure, perhaps even low blood sodium. So that's the only reason they're sitting here, is to maintain that blood pressure, okay? So aldosterone encourages sodium reabsorption by inserting sodium channels in the DCT. When we say reabsorption, what do we say is happening to that sodium? Where is it going? Back to the bloodstream, right? So that means it's going to the peritubular capillaries and that venule system on the way out. Okay, and of course water, if you reabsorb it as well, it's going the same pathway, pull it back into your peritubular capillaries, cortical radiate vein, and so forth. Now, if those hormones are present, what do you expect to see in terms of urine color and output? Urine color and output, if these are present?
Concentrated.
Yep, dark yellow, concentrated, because all your fluids are coming back into the bloodstream, right?
It took in more nutrients, right? No.
Well, the nutrients are most likely taken down here, but this time it's pulling the salt back too.
Okay.
Okay. Oops. Calcium, not calcitonin. Okay, so if you need more calcium, you can have PTH present there. That will also help you reabsorb more calcium back into the bloodstream. What calcium imbalance might you have that would necessitate more calcium being reabsorbed? hypercalcemia or hypocalcemia?
Hypo.
Yeah, meaning you've got low. All right, so here in the DCT is a good deal of secretion, and secretion is an opposite process to reabsorption. Secretion is a process that your body takes items in the bloodstream and it dumps them over into the filtrate to be discarded. So let me give you a kind of a scenario here. Let's talk about urea or uric acid, one of those waste products of metabolism. Urea may travel in through the renal artery, segmental artery, interlobar artery, arcuate artery, cortical radiate artery, afferent arteriole. It goes through the glomerulus. It's probably not filtered. It travels through the efferent arteriole. It now travels these peritubular capillaries. And then way down here at the DCT, almost out of time, your body says, oh, hey, and take this too with you. So we dump that urea or uric acid into the filtrate from the peritubular capillaries because we do not want these items. We want to dump them into the filtrate that ultimately becomes urine. So this, again, is opposite to reabsorption. We're moving these items from blood into filtrate. So besides urea and uric acid, what else is secreted?
Hydrogen.
Good. Hydrogens, potassiums.
Creatinine.
Good. Creatinine. Okay. So go ahead. Question? So under what pH conditions might you want to dump and secrete more hydrogens?
Acidic.
Okay, so if you're too acidic, you're gonna dump more hydrogens, secrete more hydrogens. That helps your blood pH come back up. Okay, so if you're already too alkaline, what should you do with your acids, your hydrogens? Let them keep riding, go in the peritubular capillaries. So you don't want to lose them if you're already too alkaline. What hormone do you think controls the potassium secretion?
Aldosterone.
Right. So if aldosterone is here at the DCT, it's causing you to reabsorb how many sodiums?
Three sodiums.
For two potassiums. Right. Three sodiums for two potassiums. So I'll just make a note here, that's aldosterone.
So if you decide you need to reabsorb the sodium at the DCT, and you already, the aldosterone will let you absorb free sodium, but then in the secretion part of the DCT, you're going to dump two.
Yeah. And in fact, there's a pump set up there, and aldosterone turns on the pump. So automatically, it's doing this exchange. Yeah. So let me give you an example. If we have somebody who's in respiratory acidosis, maybe they have emphysema, their bloodstream is becoming too acidic, your renal system can compensate with two things. Because you're in acidosis, you're too acidic, what should we do with your bicarbs?
Reabsorb
more or less of them?
More.
Take more back in because it will bring your pH back up. And
secrete more.
You're right, secrete more hydrogens because that will help you by getting rid of that acid out of your bloodstream. So if you tested the urine, would it be really acidic or really basic?
Really acidic.
Yeah, because you're letting that acid go in your urine. Okay, so, you know, that's kind of, the urine, it could be basic, it could be alkaline, depending on what you eat, depending on what your body is doing, but the most important pH is not your urine, it's your blood. By the time this filtrate makes its way to the collecting duct, there's very little reabsorption that can occur here. And of course, by the time we make our way down to the tip of this renal collecting duct, we're sticking off the tip of a renal pyramid. So from there, we're at the renal papilla. Where do we go next with this urine? Minors, majors, pelvis. Think you got it. Okay. Tip of the papilla, yeah, that renal papilla.
Okay, so let me throw some questions out at you to see how comfortable you are here. If you're traveling in the afferent arteriole compared to blood traveling in the efferent arteriole, where should you expect to find more glucose? Afferent or efferent?
Afferent.
Why?
Because
it's before it's filtered. It's before it's filtered, yeah. Because afferent's bringing you right the blood in. The next step is the glomerulus, and you filter most of that glucose out. Yeah, and efferent's next, and you haven't yet hit the peritubulars where you can pick up that glucose once again. Good. Let's see another one. Where does obligatory reabsorption of salt and water occur?
PCT.
PCT, good. Where does ADH encourage water reabsorption?
PCT.
Good. And what might necessitate you having ADH there?
Low blood pressure.
Let's see. Creatinine, is it normally filtered and reabsorbed or normally secreted?
Secreted,
right. Is it considered a nutrient or a waste product?
Waste product,
good. Urea and uric acid, what should happen to them?
Secreted,
good. Aldosterone promotes the secretion of what ion?
Potassium,
good. And the reabsorption of?
Sodium.
Under what conditions will you need more sodium?
Low blood pressure,
good. Dehydration, low blood volume, these kinds of things. Let's see. If you have high blood calcium, that condition is known as?
Hypercalcemia.
Good. Will you turn on PTH when you have hypercalcemia?
No.
Don't need it, right?
No.
Okay. How much glucose can you reabsorb in the PCT?
180.
Good. And where do you only reabsorb water by itself?
Descending
limb. That's right, not the ascending limb. Where can you reabsorb salt by itself? Ascending limb. And why are you separating the two?
To balance out the salinity.
That's right.
The salinity.
Let's see. Cortical radiate artery versus cortical radiate vein. Where should we have more creatinine?
In the
vein.
Okay, so cortical radiate artery versus cortical radiate vein. Where should you have more creatinine?
In the artery.
Oh, it's not filtered.
Okay, so your right is cortical radiate artery, but is creatinine primarily filtered and reabsorbed or secreted?
Secreted.
That's it. So down here you'll secrete it.
Yes, out the duct.
So
it's in the artery.
It's in the artery.
Yeah.
Because down here you're secreting it into the filtrate, and you get rid of it.
So it never goes to the cortical radiate vein?
There should be very little in the cortical radiate vein, right.
Question, so the efferent arteriole and the afferent arteriole, are they working at the same time?
Yeah.
In terms of blood flowing through?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the one that you normally squeeze if you need to increase blood pressure is efferent.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's the only time that is separate is when you're trying to increase the blood pressure.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Let's say that we have a sodium ion and we're going to filter it. If it's in the filtrate, can I secrete it? Okay, so think about that one. If I've got a sodium ion and I filtered it, can I then secrete that sodium ion?
Yes.
Okay, so if I filtered it, what happened to the sodium? It comes into the PCT, and then I either can reabsorb it or I can let it go in the urine. But to secrete it, where would it have to come from? Peritubular capillaries into the DCT, but if it's already in the filtrate, I can't secrete it. Okay, does that make sense? Okay, so if I'm in the filtrate already, I can't secrete myself into the filtrate, okay? Because to be secreted, you have to come from
out.
The, from the peritubular capillaries into the filtrate. Okay.
And secretion only occurs at DCT?
For our conversation, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's see. Would you expect to have more red blood cells in the afferent arteriole or the efferent arteriole or the same number?
Same amount.
Good. Would you expect to have more water in the afferent or efferent arteriole?
Afferent.
Because what happens to a lot of that water?
It gets filtered.
Would you expect to have more creatinine in afferent or efferent?
Efferent.
It's a trick question.
It's not the
one
There's some filtered, but for the most part, what do you do with most of your creatinine?
Secrete it.
So it'll be about the same. Yeah. How are you feeling with this stuff?
Better.
Okay.
I'm going to run all that down.
They came.